You're listening to the Arsenal for Democracy, forging and preparing a new generation for leadership. Now, here's your host, Bill Humphrey.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. I'm coming to you on September 1st, 2013, from our studio in Newton, Massachusetts. Ahead this hour, Persephone and I critique President Obama's proposed reforms to the cost of higher education. Then we discuss three military cases involving death penalty level crimes. And finally, we look at the shocking number of squirrel-related power failures and what that says about America's infrastructure. All this is just ahead on Arsenal for Democracy. Arsenal for Democracy is usually recorded in studio every Sunday afternoon and is available for download on Monday nights or Tuesday mornings at billhumphreyresearch.com/radio and from iTunes and other locations. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it from WVUD.org on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Email us at afdradio@gmail.com or call and leave a message with your views and questions at 347-688-6676. This is the Arsenal for Democracy. Welcome to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. I'm here in studio with Persephone. We're going to talk first about college loans. President Obama's been out campaigning around the country this summer. I still have no idea why he was doing it during the summer when no one's at school, but whatever. And campaigning for, you know, trying to rein in the costs and debts associated with a college degree, which is still economically important, but is economically more expensive. So, Persephone, let's get started. Tell us what your thoughts are on this and what the program that he's outlining is.
Yeah, so basically, President Obama has been going around to schools, like you said, UBuffalo, a few others, just all over, and has been talking about the cost of tuition and you know, is advocating for colleges and universities to lower their tuition, which I think most people can agree is a worthy goal. Recently, he said it is time to stop subsidizing schools that are not producing good results, and he has suggested the creation of federal report cards that would basically evaluate how schools. It would evaluate the value of a given school. So the idea would be that they would look at the rate of employment for students or for alumni of the school, and that they would see what kinds of jobs they're working in. They would look at how well those jobs pay and that sort of thing, and compare it to the cost of the schools. The thing about this is, while it is a great idea, I think, to make sure that all these schools have this information available so that people can make informed decisions about where they want to go to school, I do think that it's a little bit risky to do it in this way.
Well, to tie consequences to that is kind of the issue here.
Right. I mean, the idea, one of the suggestions was that that federal subsidies and grants would be connected to this so that a school that has a poor report card would not get as much, that would not get as many grants, would not get as much federal aid. And I mean, this is something that the U.S. government has been doing for a long time. They don't really have any control over private colleges and universities except insofar as controlling how much federal money they get to support them. And, you know, most of the time this has been used for positive things, one example being integration of private schools so that there would be equal access for Black and white students. And, you know, things like that are very valuable, and it's a good thing that they do have that kind of access and that level of control. But the problem is, if you really think about this sort of higher education, no child left behind, I mean, let's think about if they're really going to be measuring things based on the salaries that people are making after they graduate from a school. Well, already a lot of public sector jobs that have been cut by the federal government are going to result in graduates of a school having a lower salary. So,
or getting hired less frequently.
Right.
And which I think, and you were saying, you were alluding briefly there to No Child Left Behind. I think what you're saying there is kind of that the same problem of No Child Left Behind, where you're punishing the people that are already having the most trouble, is that you would effectively be punishing schools that have, that are training people for tougher fields, you know, with lower salaries and things like teachers and various things like that. And instead of helping them to improve or increasing the number of qualified graduates or getting helping boost pay rates, they're just punishing schools for something that's beyond their control.
Right, absolutely. And I mean, teaching is one of the biggest concerns that I have. I mean, there are certainly other jobs that have those same problems, but I think that the idea of these people that are going out into communities and are sacrificing their pay. They're saying rather than pursue something, you know, like finance where I can just make a ton of money, they're saying, you know, I'm going to, you know, this is something that I'm passionate about. It's something I can do to make a difference and change people's lives for the better. And I'm going to do it even though I'm not going to make a lot of money. You know, certainly I know people that come from backgrounds where they went through an education system that only was held together by the strength of their teachers. And they said, I want to go and continue to make a difference in schools like my own. And people do this knowing they're not going to make money. So to punish a school because it produces a lot of teachers or a lot of people in the nonprofit sector or a lot of people, you know, doing other kinds of work.
Yeah, it just seems like a really strange way of measuring and dealing with it, because I agree with your original point that it is important for this information to be easily accessible, that there should be an objective way of comparing like two schools, you know, within a program or something like, you know, does this school have a better rate of getting me hired at a higher salary for a given degree that is also offered by a different school? But it is very strange to be comparing different salary rates and things across various fields, especially starting salaries. I mean, you know, you could use the example of teachers, or you could use any number of things where, like, why would you be comparing the starting base rate of chemical engineers to, say, you know, some other relatively low paying thing or something like that? I mean, even arguably with the finance, you know, that starts getting tricky because a lot of the places that you have a low salary and then are paid in bonuses and stuff determined by your work performance and things like that, which, you know, you can go back to last episode and hear our thoughts on the problems of that. But in fairness, that would skew the statistics kind of like in terms of how that is measured. And it is very difficult to cross compare because certain things, there's a fewer number of people, so they get paid more, or, you know, it's a higher skill thing, you know, it takes more advanced degrees, various things. Like, obviously, you know, one thing that comes up a lot about the costs of med school and the U.S. healthcare system and the amount that doctors are paid and stuff. And this is true to some degree for lawyers as well, but especially doctors, where they have to go through these long, long processes of their undergraduate degree and then another degree and then med school and a residency and blah, 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 that, you know, there's the argument, oh, well, you got to pay them a pretty high starting salary in a lot of cases because they've had to go through years of very expensive education stuff. I mean, of course, some of this is a cyclical problem and then gets back into why we should be controlling these. But the idea that you're comparing across fields and starting salaries, that gets to be a big problem. You know, I went to a school that was heavily dominated by engineering programs, chemical engineering and stuff specifically, University of Delaware. And that, you know, feeds into the big chemical engineering and chemical firms of, you know, Dow and DuPont and Gore. But that is, you know, it's a completely different thing. It would be unfair to compare it to, say, a teacher's college that's specifically training teachers, you know, somewhere else. Obviously, the University of Delaware has its own teacher program within it, but that's a bigger university. Like, what about someplace that's dedicated to just, you know, training teachers? There aren't that many of them, I think, as compared to what there used to be maybe 50, 60 years ago. But there still are some, and it would be unfair to say, look at the high starting salaries that these entry-level chemical engineers get versus this school that almost entirely produces teachers.
Lovely
that
just college.
Yeah, that exactly. That wouldn't be a fair way of measuring and cross-comparing the performance. So it's valuable to have that information, but it starts becoming a problem when you're attaching consequences to that information. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I would. And I think another issue here is that, you know, obviously, as I said before, this is a big problem. People are graduating college with mountains of debt. Hopefully that's not too much of a cliche at this point, but people...
I think that's completely fair. The last statistic I saw was that the outstanding student debt in this country is a cumulative $1 trillion. So I think that that it's completely fine to use various, you know, borderline hyperbolic cliches.
Yeah, but I mean, the point is that, you know, there people are graduating with these big issues, and, you know, certainly a lot of people aren't going to go into teaching for that reason. The issue here is it's not just a problem of high tuition, it's also a problem of high interest rates on loans and of you know, predatory lending and you know, a lot of these, you know, big groups that just use college loans specifically as a way to make themselves millions of dollars.
Right. And that can be the lenders, that can also be the private institutions, because there's been many cases where private institutions, the reason that the costs are going up so rapidly and so dramatically is because they're effectively manipulating the system. They know that you can just take out more loans, whether federal or otherwise, to pay off their, you know, their tuition, so they can raise the tuition artificially. Now, obviously, that ends up having consequences. We just alluded to that massive amount of debt that American students and recent graduates and even long since graduated people are still under. And, you know, and you can't get out of that, as we've talked about before on the show. It's the one debt that you can't go default on or go bankrupt on. You have to continue to pay it. And that's a relatively recent reform, too, just, I think, since about 2000. And, you know, some of these colleges, not every college is doing this. I'm not going to frame it like some, you know, nefarious plot or whatever, but certainly some of them are. They're basically scamming the system and saying, look, we're going to jack up our tuition rates because we know you can take federal loans. Now, the most abusive specific form that's been recently kind of discussed was there was a Washington Post expose on how Georgetown Law was essentially scamming this program. They had very generously said, oh, we're going to help provide free or reduced law school fees for people who do pro bono work and things like that, other low-paying forms of law, you know, as opposed to, say, training corporate law, where you can make millions of dollars after not a whole lot of time, if you're good at your job, obviously. But, you know, you know, that seems noble, of saying we'll provide you free law school experience, or we'll cut your law school or forgive your debt. That was the big selling point, was that after a certain amount of time, your debt was going to be forgiven. You know, and the federal government kind of jumped onto this. They created this program. They said, okay, the law school pays for part of it. That goes to the federal government. And the federal government provides you unlimited loans. And then if you work for 10 years in this low paying thing like pro bono law, then then the rest of your debt is forgiven. You don't have to do it anymore. So what should have happened there is that the federal government pays for part of it by effectively giving you, you know, a low interest loan that you don't have to pay off all of if you do this, you know, follow through on this commitment. And then the law school pays for the other part of it. But what Georgetown Law figured out, according to the Washington Post, was that because you could take an unlimited federal loan, what they could do was just jack up their own tuition, because you don't, at the end of the day, you're not on the hook for all the money as the student, because eventually it'll be forgiven 10 years down the line. And the federal government is going to be paying for it. And they're supposed to pay the federal government for part of this program. So, you know, like a percentage of it. I don't know if it was 50% or something. But if they jack up their tuition rate, you just, for you as the student to pay it, this increased tuition, you just take out more loans from the federal government. And then the law school ends up paying the amount that their share of the program they pay to the federal government, using this federal loan money that has been funneled through the student. And then they don't end up having to pay for any of the program themselves, and the federal government ends up on the hook for all of it. Now, that's a particularly abusive kind of scam, in my opinion, and I think that's a problem that needs to be stopped. But that at the very least, is the federal government getting stuck with the bill as opposed to the student getting stuck with the bill. In a lot of cases, students are the ones getting stuck with these from predatory lenders and things like that, as Persephone was saying, where the student is going to end up getting screwed over by this and having to pay off these loans that they can't possibly pay back, given the increasing tuition rates. Or it's not even necessarily the predatory lenders, as I started, you know, by saying this, was that sometimes it's the institutions that are being abusive about it, and they are jacking up their tuition knowing that you can, oh, just go get more student loans. But at the end of the day, or at least the end of 20 years from now, you still have to be paying off those loans.
Right. And I think that it's really not, it's not a good idea to punish schools based on these results. When if your goal is to reduce student loan student debt, then you should be looking at solutions for the tuition rate itself and solutions for the way that loans are managed. You shouldn't be looking at this idea of the pure sort of, you know, financial benefit of the degree. I mean, I think it's a reasonable thing. Like I said, I think it's a very good thing for those records to be available. But people are not basing their choice of school or even what they're going to study purely for financial reasons. There are many considerations for people who are deciding what they want to do with their lives. And while they should have the information available of what that's going to mean for them in the future, their programs should not suffer because they choose to go into something that is not a big moneymaker.
Now, here's another thought that I was having, which is, what about this? And this is, gets into these cycle things again, where you, you know, you look at, you know, which came first and that sort of thing, chicken or the egg, the student base salary coming out of college versus their student loans, all that kind of thing. What about this? Is this going to be a part of the assessment? This, you know, are you getting the same quality level education at a place versus what your college's reputation is, which affects your starting salary? So for example, I would imagine that Harvard or any number of the other Ivy League schools, their students probably have a lot easier time getting hired and then getting hired at a higher starting pay rate in a lot of different fields. I don't, you know, I'm not going to cite specifics because I don't know. I'm just sort of speculating. But theoretically, on paper, schools like that, they have a certain reputation and cachet associated with them. That's going to at least somewhat affect the pay rates and employment rates out of the gate. But not to be too cliche about it, but like you can get as good an education at a lot of other places. And should, you know, should your ranking, your school's report card or whatever, if this system gets implemented, be affected because your school has a unfair or arbitrary, at least, reputation that, you know, because they're not an Ivy League school or they're not XYZ, that, you know, you might be getting just fine. Like, are we going to have a flip side of the report card that tells employers, by the way, you should actually consider hiring this person because they, you know, didn't go to, you know, the fancy name tag school thing, but they did go to someplace that gave them just as good an education. And obviously, it's not like every school is created equal. Some of them don't. But, and that's where I think that the colleges, that might be actually genuinely very helpful to a lot of students and employers, but it's just not helpful to the colleges. And a lot of them seem to be up in arms about this thing. They don't want to see any kind of federal way of setting benchmarks and a way of determining measurements. That seems to be something that they are going to fight on the beaches, in the fields, and in the streets. So I think that that's something where that would actually help. And it's not necessarily a consequences thing. It's like what Persephone was saying at the beginning about having the useful information available, but not necessarily penalizing or punishing people. Like, I don't think employers should be punished, say, for hiring, you know, people with a certain cachet, but they should also have the information available to say, oh, wait, I could get someone who's, you know, just as qualified, but maybe went to a less expensive, less selective school. I don't know what you thought about that particular angle. That was kind of a new one that I just thought of.
Yeah, that hadn't actually occurred to me. I think that the one thing is that anytime something like this, you know, like these report cards, anytime something like that happens or goes public, my big concern is that a lot of people are not so good at understanding methodology.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point.
So I would be a little concerned. I think that the one valid complaint that schools would have is that people might misread or misunderstand what the measurements mean.
Yeah, and I suppose it has more weight if it's like, well, this is according to the federal government or whatever, as opposed to this is U.S. News and World Report going off and sitting in its mystical Sweat Lodge den and coming up with rankings that seem to be based on absolutely nothing, you know, which has been a criticism of their rankings. And I think that is a pretty valid criticism, to be fair, that, yeah, you know, how is the methodology done? And no one ever looks at the methodologies and people just go, oh, this is, I saw some headline about such and such. And no one ever seems to understand that, which is, you know, I can see why that's a problem. But I feel like there's got to be some way of measuring it. I mean, at the risk of sounding like, you know, a No Child Left Behind fanatic of like, we've got to have a way of measuring, you know, because some stuff you can't quantify. You know, and even quality of education, you know, is this as quality as a Harvard education or whatever? Like, that can be something that's tough to quantify.
I would really like to see a sort of national report on grade inflation at schools. That is something I would like to see.
Like at the college level or the high school level?
Yes, at the college level. Because I think that is something that could be that's something that employers could actually use. The ones that actually look at GPA and things like that, which not all of them do, but
right.
That could be a valuable
thing. Yeah, and well, that's another thing too, is like just the variability, and this ties back to the like, how do you measure across fields and stuff? I know from my experience at UD that like, I, as a political science major, or people that I knew who were history majors, were going to have an easier time getting an A than somebody who was a chemistry major or something like that, or a chemical engineer. That those were easier at that specific school, those were easier to get better grades in than the much more tough engineering degrees, which I don't want to say that to be insulting to my own, you know, political science degree or anything like that. But I did acknowledge at the time that my fellow students who were in some of those more tough majors, they were, you know, they could be putting in huge amounts of work and be happy to get a B or something like that. And that would be maybe the high end grade that, you know, different majors within the same university. It's not even that big of a school relative to some of these other really huge schools, like a really big, really, really big state school that you get in some like California or Michigan or New York or Ohio or something. There was just tremendous variation. And I think even like the UD Review and stuff, the newspaper there, they periodically do articles about what's the like average grade that, you know, you'd see in these different majors or whatever. And like, it's not uniform in any way. And that makes it extra hard to measure effectively. You haven't even left college at that point. It starts breaking down like your ability to accurately cross compare.
Not to mention the fact, I mean, you know, my school had a medieval studies major. But, you know, every year there would be, you know, one medieval studies major, if that. So how would you measure something like grade inflation when you have just one person a year?
It's not a very good representative sample, to say the least.
Right.
Well, Arsenal for Democracy will be right back after a short break. BillHumphreyResearch.com/radio. Back in a moment with more from yours truly, Bill Humphrey, and my co-host Persephone. Welcome back to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. I'm here in studio, as usual, with Persephone. Turning now to sort of foreign policy, military policy. Obviously, the big story that's been happening in the past couple of weeks, we didn't talk about it on last week's show, and we're not really going to talk about it too much on this week's show, has been the Syria situation. Chemical weapons were used by somebody on the side of the regime. It seems clear at this point. They've tested positive, some of the aid workers, for sarin gas exposure. So we definitely know it was used. We don't know if it was used by the Assad regime. There was a big ramp up to military action that was cut short by the UK Parliament very narrowly voting against any military intervention in Syria by the government of the United Kingdom. And the Arab League didn't support it. The UN's not going to support it. The French said yes, and then Obama finally decided to pump the brakes a little bit and wait till Congress comes back on September 9th before there's any vote taken on any action. So it's gone from imminent, you know, any minute this could start, to we're going to wait a couple weeks and see, which is part of why we're not going to cover it, because there's not a whole lot to cover in that respect that's happened since. This is almost all happened since we last recorded our episode last Saturday within a day or two of the initial incident. The other reason that I wasn't going to cover it in a whole lot of detail was just because you are more than welcome to listen to past episodes of Arsenal for Democracy at BillHumphreyResearch.com/radio. And you'll hear that our position on the Syria stuff hasn't really changed a whole lot, I don't think. I mean, I can't necessarily speak for Persephone, but I think we've broadly covered and I have definitely made my position clear, and that hasn't changed just because the chemical weapons have been used, is that I don't think that an intervention is going to help the situation much and could, in fact, make it worse and various other reasons. So I don't feel that my position has particularly changed. So there's no real need to rehash that completely. We've talked about Syria plenty of times at great length on many episodes. Did you generally concur with that, broadly speaking?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that my feelings of hopelessness have changed. I would not say that my feelings on what should happen. I mean, I've gone a little bit back and forth about it, but I wouldn't say that I've had a dramatic shift as a result of anything that's happened.
Right. So what we were going to talk about instead of something that's going to get probably a lot less coverage, but still a military-related issue. So there's a New Yorker article that was posted on August 28th, 2013. And it was about these three military cases, two recently, involving Nidal Malik Hassan and Sergeant Robert Bales. And they were both involved. They were both military officers involved in mass killings, and they were being brought up on court-martial, etc. What happened here was that one of them was a Muslim major at an army base in I believe, Texas, and he killed 13 soldiers and wounded dozens more in a shooting spree. And then there was, you know, he was charged with 45 counts of premeditated murder and attempted premeditated murder. Obviously, he was guilty, but he chose not to plead guilty because he wanted the option to be sentenced to death. And he was, in fact, sentenced to death shortly after this article was posted. That was in Texas. And then there was a case in Washington State where there's an Army Air Force base, and they had a jury there. And the staff sergeant, Robert Bales, had, while he was serving in Kandahar province in Afghanistan, went on a one-man rampage through some village on March 11th, 2012, and he murdered 16 civilian villagers, a number of women and children. They were all completely unarmed. There was no threat or anything. I don't remember off the top of my head all the details of the case, but basically he was either under the influence or having some sort of mental break or something. But, you know, no excuse for this, obviously. And he went on this rampage and killed 16 people. So there was also no doubt that he was guilty. He ended up taking a guilty plea because if he pled guilty, then there was no option of being sentenced to death. But then there was, the jury got to decide whether he was going to be sentenced to life in prison without parole or with parole. He was sentenced to life in prison without parole, unsurprisingly. And they actually, the article notes that very interestingly in this case, the army brought in a number of Afghan villagers, relatives of the people killed to testify in this trial. And apparently those family members were not happy about this because they wanted him to be sentenced to death. They felt like he got off too easy. But this has raised some interesting questions, or at least the image problems besides those people being upset with the outcome is that there's this kind of sentiment that the Muslim officer is being sentenced to die and the Catholic, white guy, blonde officer is being given life in prison. Now, again, some of this is just the circumstances of how the system is set up, but this is raising some pretty serious questions in a lot of people's minds. Who have been at least paying attention to this. And compounding this has been that there was another case, U.S. Army Sergeant Hassan Karim Akbar, who was an African-American who had converted. That was not his original name. He converted to Islam along with his parents, and he ended up killing two American soldiers while he was serving in the Middle East. I think he was maybe in Kuwait or something. This was not something that happened like right on the front lines. And he was sentenced to death and has been at Fort Leavenworth. So we've got two Muslim officers who are getting death sentences for shooting sprees, and the one Catholic guy who didn't. So again, some of this is not it's unavoidable. That's how the system is set up. And if you choose to not plead guilty and you get convicted and sentenced, then it's an option. But it does set up an interesting dichotomy, and I think it fuels this sentiment that is that this widespread view that seems kind of a little bit merited, at least, that the United States is kind of participating in these anti-Muslim campaigns, you know, that that's the point of these interventions in the Middle East or something. And obviously, I don't think that at the highest levels that's the goal, but you can still say that that's the ancillary effect. And then there was a Guardian piece that I saw yesterday, which I didn't agree with all of it, but it was arguing that when you combine that stuff with these various anti-Sharia law efforts passed in various states that we've talked about on the show, Oklahoma, North Carolina, those sort of places, and you get the, you know, various attacks on mosques and things like that, and the NYPD targeting mosques as terrorist centers and whatever, and the FBI eavesdropping, all those sort of things, it does start to add up to a very unpleasant picture, at the least. Even if it's not part of some conscious effort, it does alienate a lot of folks. And, you know, as the one common phrase in these Muslim, especially Muslim American communities goes, is that a lot of Muslims feel like the terrorist groups and stuff and these people who go crazy or whatever and do shooting sprees, that those people are as Muslim as the Westboro Baptist Church is Christian, which is to say not very. They take that mantle on, but they don't necessarily... the other people in the religion don't necessarily consider them to be part of that religion. But it's an alienating thing, and it fuels a lot of these sentiments in the Middle East. And it's not like people are unaware of these things. We see these incidents, you know, these blow-ups over cartoons or, preachers flushing Qurans down the toilet, various offensive things, things that were reported at Guantanamo Bay that had happened. These things definitely get reported around. There was a recent article in the New York Times by a guy who had been, he was a photojournalist, was held kidnapped for like a year or something, or several, or 8 months or something, in Syria. And at one point when he was being tortured, they specifically cited Guantanamo Bay. These are things that are known about and perceived and referred to and discussed in these situations. It is going to alienate and radicalize some people. You obviously can't control that for everyone. Some people are just going to end up getting radicalized no matter what. But you don't need to be providing extra fuel to the fire on these things. And again, I don't know what necessarily could have been done differently in these situations, but it is a problematic thing when no one has been executed by the military. You know, none of our own troops have been executed by the military since 1961, and now we've got two Muslim officers sentenced to death, and we've got the white Catholic, you know, small town boy is going to be given, you know, life sentence in prison. And again, that was sort of, he kind of played the system a little bit to work out that, but you know, all these things sort of compound together and they fuel a lot of resentments that are problems. There was a great article in the New York Times after the Syria attack was postponed, and they were quoting various people. And of course, you know, to some extent, it's a self-selecting group of people who are willing to speak in English to the New York Times, and that some of them are definitely more aware, just in the same way that if in the United States, not everyone is paying attention to world affairs. And if you talk to the people who know about them, then obviously you're talking to the people who know about them. But there was some funny remarks, like one guy saying, you know, man, I wish Bush was still president, because he would do something right away. He might accidentally attack Cyprus or Jordan, but at least he'd be doing something. Obviously being sarcastic about the whole thing, but you know, it's not like people aren't paying attention when these sort of colossal blunders are made, or these fudging of the lines and kind of mixing all these people together, like the Bush administration claiming that Saddam Hussein was in league with Al-Qaeda, even though he didn't really support those groups. Like he did support some terrorist activities, but they were the secular Palestinian terrorist organizations like the PLO. He wasn't supporting Hamas, the Islamist groups. He wasn't supporting Al-Qaeda. He was cracking down. The Al-Qaeda people did not get along with people like Saddam Hussein, who were these secular leaders who wanted to enforce secularism and were very much opposed to this sort of greater caliphate thing. But if the United States blurs the lines on those two together, then it's like, look, you're coming into our country blowing things up, but you don't know what's going on. You haven't actually been paying attention. You haven't put in the research, the historical contextualizing information. And this all starts to add up to a pattern. Even if there isn't really a pattern there, it starts to look like one.
I would argue that there is, in fact, you know, pretty serious issue with discrimination against Muslims in the United States.
Right.
I don't think you were necessarily disputing that, but I don't think that this is necessarily, like you said, a deliberate attempt to target Muslim officers specifically.
But But even if it's not deliberate, it's like you gotta acknowledge that it's happening and be conscious of that and try to fix it.
Exactly. I think that what's happening here is we have these cases. In one case, the article even says it's a deliberate attempt to become a martyr figure. Obviously, Bales pleads guilty as a way to avoid the death sentence because he doesn't have those motives.
But they could have not sentenced the other guy to death, which I just was thinking about, right? Like, I think if he doesn't plead guilty, they could have sentenced him to life. There's no reason that the two guys that did get death sentences had to get death sentences.
No, I mean, they could have sentenced them both to life. They clearly didn't read this article, let's just put it that way, because, I mean, it's
an issue of perception, and whether or not it's your intent doesn't matter. Even if you have the best intentions possible, if you still do something that's a problem, you need to fix it, and you need to try to be aware of how it's going to look.
Right. When you have these situations that are so, in some ways, so much parallels, you really need to be careful that you are making sure that things have a similar result. I think in both of these cases, I mean, I'm not, you know, I think that, you know, whether or not somebody, I mean, I'm not saying that the death penalty should be applied to both cases necessarily. I'm saying that once one person pleads guilty and has that option eliminated, you need to look at what's happening in the second case and you know, just make
right. And they are independent cases, but, you know, and I guess it speaks to a larger issue of should it even be an option. And that's kind of a separate thing about the death penalty as an option. But yeah, I think even though they're independent cases, like, it's a problem, you know, maybe. But then the president can't, like, commute the sentence, because then everyone will go completely nuts, which was, I think, a thing brought up in this New Yorker piece, was that he could technically commute the sentences to life in prison as opposed to the death penalty. But then, you know, the Fox News, right-wing talk radio and stuff would lose their minds for the rest of his term in office.
Right.
And so he's kind of in this catch-22 position. And people are going to say he's a terrorist sympathizer or whatever. And it's like, you know, this is the problem, is like, you've now created this problematic situation.
Which ties back into the Guardian article as well, which is, you know, how much power, you know.
Right. It's not President Obama's fault that there's Muslim American discrimination, but how much power does he really have to fix it? Which was my issue with that particular article. Not her contention that there was discrimination against Muslim Americans. That is definitely happening.
Which I understood.
Right. Yeah. Arsenal for Democracy will be right back after this break. Welcome back to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey, here, as always, with my co-host, Persephone, in studio. I wanted to talk about the issue of the terrible U.S. electrical grid. The kind of key thing here is that we are coming up in just a couple months on the one-year anniversary of Hurricane Sandy, which just completely destroyed a lot of the electrical grid in a lot of New Jersey, parts of Long Island, Connecticut, that sort of thing, even New York very briefly. But New Jersey had power out in some places for 2 weeks. I mean, just craziness in terms of how much destruction. And you could say, oh, hey, it's a hurricane. That's really big, right? You know, so that's a pretty serious problem. But we're also just past the 10-year anniversary of the big Northeast blackout, where there was, you know, one like a stick fell on a thing somewhere and it overloaded something, which overloaded something else, and it took out power for what, like 7 states or something, or 13 states, I don't know, and a bunch of provinces in Canada as well, because there's some cross-border integration between some of the power things. And so that, I think, you know, is a bit of an indication that Washington Post you know, noting that there's a lot of the U.S. grid is still just wires between wooden telephone poles and that kind of thing. That's how our grid is set up. I mean, the amazing levels of antiquation are just stunning. There was an NPR article about the 10-year anniversary of the blackout, noting that we have come almost nowhere in terms of our ability to protect the grid and to keep it from actually having these problems. They've got some sort of disruptor type things and rerouting things and smart grids and blah, blah, blah. But some of that just isn't that advanced. Now, to give you a sense of the scope of how not advanced the U.S. grid is, There was a New York Times article that that was just absolutely fascinating. I definitely encourage everyone to check this out. And this was, you know, basically they took something that you think would not be a big thing at all. And this was published on August 31st. And it was about squirrel-induced power outages. Okay, so this guy said that he noticed this article a while back, this author guy. He noticed this article a while back that said, oh, a squirrel on a power line had caused a power outage in some place. And it was, you know, big outage, maybe a couple thousand people lost their power or whatever, and it's out for a while. So basically, the way that this works is that a squirrel unfortunately gets electrocuted by touching two parts of, you know, the wires or whatever that are, you know, causes a short circuit. And they're supposed to be redundancy systems that basically will restart it after a second. So, you know, that's when you see the power blip briefly and then it comes back on and it doesn't stay out for like a minute or anything. It just is like flicks off and then comes right back on again. You know, sometimes even just the lights will dim. But if the poor squirrel accidentally gets stuck after being electrocuted and is just like completing a short circuit permanently until removed by a power grid official, then that is a permanent outage that overrides the redundancies and just takes the power out. So that's how you get the situation that he initially noticed. But so this guy thought, hey, I'm really curious. I wonder how often this actually happens. So he set up a Google alert, squirrel power, and then just looked for all the news hits since that incident earlier this summer about squirrels, you know, falling on a power line and taking out the power. And he very quickly discovered that not only is this astonishingly common, but these squirrels can take out power for tens of thousands of people in some cases. Sometimes it's, you know, just 2,000 or 3,000 people, although that's still a pretty significant amount. But he was saying there were, you know, multiple occasions where it would be 10,000, 13,000, 20,000 people losing their power for at least, you know, an hour, or depending on the time of day or night, it could even be several hours, or they have to figure out where it is or how to get, you know, get it removed. And, you know, that becomes a pretty serious impact. There's an economic effect and so on and so forth. And if a tree branch falling on a line somewhere can cause the power to go out for New York City and the entire Northeast and parts of Canada, then a squirrel can basically do the same thing. And that should be shocking, especially 10 years after the blackout. But what's really shocking is that he goes through and counts up and he says that all these articles, despite these happening hundreds of times this summer, and taking out power for thousands and thousands of people, is that these articles always make it sound like this is an isolated freak problem that doesn't happen constantly. But he says it does happen constantly. It's all over the country, happening on a regular basis, and there are many factors for this and why it would be increasing as well in, you know, recent years, but recent being defined as the past half century, which is that there's a lot more suburban development in areas with, you know, they plant nice shade trees like oak trees that squirrels already love, and they plant those near the power lines, or they grow up next to the power lines. They get too close, squirrels try to jump, they miss, they cause a power outage and die. And you know, that this is a problem, but there's no statistics. The power company doesn't have statistics, local government doesn't have statistics, the federal government doesn't have statistics, and that just goes to show, you know, it's one small factor, but it's an encapsulation of the absolute problematic nature and rundown, antiquated nature of the United States power grid. There was a statistic that I saw that's really stuck with me from an article in The Economist back in, gosh, it must have been like 2007 or 2006. And they were saying that a lot of the design has been around since the Westinghouse Edison wars of the late 1800s in terms of what the power grid was going to be. And when we ended up using alternating current, because direct current at the time, we couldn't figure out how to make it go a longer distance without kind of, you know, running out of steam, so to speak. We ended up using alternating current on these grids that aren't even insulated for high tension power lines. You know, those really big ones that you see across the countryside if you go out far enough. And those can lose as much as 50% of their electricity. That means that, you know, for all those coal-fired power plants, those wind turbines, those gas-fired power plants, those potentially dangerous nuclear power plants, all these things churning away, you know, at least the wind doesn't have much impact, but the coal and the gas and everything, and even the oil-fired power plants, those are putting out pollutants, dust, things like that, causing these environmental damages, health damages. We have to get it out of the ground. We have to get these fuel sources. All that, half of the power that they're generating is being wasted because the high tension power lines carrying them from the power stations to the substations and things like that, that is getting completely lost. It's just kind of drifting away, so to speak, from these wires. That is an incredible amount of waste that's happening. And it should be really shocking. Now, how shocking should it be? Well, let's look at this National Geographic article by Masoud Amin from July 9th, 2013. It said the U.S. is planning a $7 billion effort to electrify Africa. That's not the United States spending $7 billion on improving the U.S. grid at home. It's spending it on improving it and expanding it in Africa, which I don't object to on its face, but the particularly shocking, surprising fact that you get out of this National Geographic thing is that the president's proposal is $7 billion to Africa to bring electricity to 20 million households and businesses in six nations alone, just six nations. And it's in particularly going to be in rural areas. You know, we know that from our own experience that rural electrification, like that was done in the 1930s, especially with the Tennessee Valley Authority and all that, is critically important to spurring development and both human and economic development. That is massively important. So it is very important that this is happening. But those improvements in the U.S. were done in the 1930s. This is being done in rural Africa now, and they're going to be using the top-of-the-line, state-of-the-art technology to electrify Africa, which means that rural Africa is going to have a more advanced grid by 2020 or whenever this is completed, which is going to be pretty soon, or 2030 or whatever the date was. And meanwhile, the United States is still going to be having these 1880s, 1890s grids that are barely any more advanced than having these, you know, gas arc lamp things or whatever. Like, you know, just it's like we're just barely out the door of this development, and we haven't done these improvements. We've done some of these very small improvements about disruption and protection, but man, you would think for all the amount of movies and books written about, you know, theoretical electromagnetic terrorist attacks or whatever, taking out the grid, you'd think we would have actually done something at this point to protect these grids, not just from terrorists, but from squirrels. I mean, why are we worried about Al-Qaeda taking out the U.S. grid when a squirrel can fall on a thing and take out, you know, potentially, there was one article cited in the example about taking out a water treatment station so that people had to boil their water in this town, because this is exactly what all the fiction is warning us about these terrorist attacks, like that we're gonna all be drinking poisoned water or whatever because of a terrorist. Look, squirrels don't have a jihadist agenda, and they're still taking out these stations.
It's pretty nutty.
So this is an improvement that absolutely needs to be made, and we really can't afford to delay on so many factors this. And, you know, we're busy talking about putting in broadband into rural areas of this country, which I completely 100% agree with. That's also vitally important for continuing our economic and social development in the United States. But we also need to be, you know, putting some of these lines underground so that they're less exposed, insulating them better, upgrading them so they're not just these, you know, I mean, literally, it's like we're stringing telegraph wires across the country in the 1870s. Seriously, that's our big plan for continuing our electrical grid in this country? It's astonishing. And meanwhile, we've got other countries who are, you know, like Ireland, for example, who are saying, look, we've put up a lot of wind turbines. We're generating more wind power than we need. We can sell it to Great Britain. You know, and Colin Cleary, who's on who's in Ireland on leave from the State Department right now, he published an article at The Globalist on June 15th. That's my employer. And this thing was about doubling down on wind. And they're saying that they're continuing to get more and more of their power from wind power. And they're saying, look, as long as we're making all these wind power improvements and all the associated technology with that, we want to become this hub of, you know, grid management. So not just the wind turbines themselves and making sure that we can generate, you know, maximum wind power at certain, you know, depending on the wind speeds and everything, those more flexible advanced turbines. But they're saying, let's also figure out how to deal with the grid management so we can reroute some of the power across the across to Great Britain some of the time, right? And we can, you know, continue to get some of it, keep some of it for ourselves when we need more of it. And, you know, and just these sort of basic management techniques, well beyond these so-called smart grids and smart meter systems that we hear about in the United States that haven't done a whole lot, actually, or at least we haven't made much progress on installing them, even if they are merited and important. which I've seen some debates on whether or not they are. But, you know, just these basic things of like, let's make ourselves the world capital of figuring out how to manage and redirect your power around a grid in an efficient manner that gets the power where it needs to be, when it needs to be, with minimum losses. And, you know, if we're going to be doing all these investments on making sure we get wind power and stuff, and that was why The Economist had written that article a number of years ago, if we're going to make sure we know how to generate wind power and we know how to store wind power, we also need to be able to move it from point A to point B, where the wind is to where the people are, because people don't actually live in super windy places most of the time, for self-evident reasons. And, you know, we need to be able to get the power from point A to point B without losing 50% of it along the way. So, you know, this idea is just amazing to me that we haven't gotten here. Now, Persephone, did you have any particular thoughts on this kind of state of play here and the fact that squirrels are basically the terrorists of modern America?
I really don't have that much to say, except that, like, especially in these rural regions, you know, where you get, like, you know, to fix a power cord, you know, if a power line goes down, you know, the people have to, like, they can't even get up there with a van or anything. They have to, like, walk up a mountain, stuff like that, in some parts of Vermont. Like, that's not a working system. That's not a good way to have power be distributed.
Right, and the power shouldn't be out in New Jersey, you know, a advanced, modernized state, for 2 weeks. Like, and I'm not saying that's New Jersey's fault. I'm saying this is the fault of how the system is set up. That there shouldn't be, you know, yeah, it's a hurricane, fine, but it shouldn't cause that much damage. You know, and that is fairly, I think, you know, it's a bigger problem probably in places that don't deal with hurricanes as much, but still, you know, you get blackouts as the, you know, that Washington Post and the Globalist had pointed out, you get little blackouts from a big thunderstorm or something because a tree falls on a power line, even in, you know, Washington, D.C. area and the neighboring suburbs around there. It's the richest metro region in the country, and we're still having these problems from the 1800s that are, you know, fed through trees for decorative purposes to keep them from looking totally ugly, but they're just not prepared for natural attacks, let alone these cyber and terrorist attacks. All right, well, Persephone, thank you so much for joining me again this week on Arsenal for Democracy.
I will see you next week.
Well, that's all the time we have this week. Thanks for listening to Arsenal for Democracy for September 1st, 2013. The show is recorded at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts every week, usually on Sundays, and is available for download from billhumphreyresearch.com/radio on Monday nights or Tuesday mornings. You can also hear a repeat of it on 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in Delaware, or at WVUD.org every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Eastern. Special thanks to my voiceover man, Justin, and my co-host, Persephone. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message. Good night.